Alaska Public Media's fall drive is well underway, and your support has been incredible. I'm Kristen Hall, the Director of Member Engagement. You can show your support today by clicking on that Make a Contribution button to your right. Thanks for choosing Alaska Public Media.
Welcome to Hometown Alaska. I'm your host, Kathleen McCoy. Our discussion today started with a listener in early September, Nancy, who wanted to learn more about food waste in landfills and what the consumer could do to personally stem that tide. That's our show today. We take you from the fridge to the landfill and points in between with guests who work daily on this very topic. Before I introduce them, I urge you to visit our site, alaskapublic.org, for the many links that I've associated with this show. We've got activists in other countries who've used their consumer power to persuade grocery stores to stop giving discounts for bulk buying. You'll find a link to a young chef in Europe who only cooks and caters with out-of-date food. He calls it bio-catering. We even found the original NPR program that piqued Nancy's interest about Selina Jewell of Denmark, who launched a consumer movement in the West after she emigrated from Russia. And there's also a link to a brand new kitchen handbook, sort of a no-waste kitchen handbook, and a cookbook with tips on also how not to waste food in the kitchen. So there's a lot of resources there, and if this topic interests you, I hope you'll go check them out. And if you find others that you want us to add here, if there's a growing community of people here in Anchorage that want this information, we can always add more links. So I hope this topic grabs you. It grabbed Nancy. It grabbed me when I started looking around in it. And to talk about it and to talk to about various aspects of it, I've got several guests. We actually have four guests today. I'd like to welcome Danny Constantine with us from Palmer. Hi, Danny.
Hi, Kathleen.
He's calling in. He was too busy to even drive down here. He's the meetings before, meetings after this, but thank you for joining us. He is with the Alaska Farm Service Agency with the USDA. And we also have Mark Madden, Manager of Engineering and Planning for the Municipal Solid Waste Facility, the landfill. Welcome, Mark.
Thank you.
So glad to have you. And then we have Carla Jutzi. Did I do that right, Carla? Okay.
Jutzi,
okay. With the Food Bank of Alaska.
Hi, Kathleen.
And so glad to have you here. Carla and I have talked many times over many topics, and this is the first time I think we each saw each other face-to-face. And then finally, Kathy Steen with Green Sanctuary and a whole career in waste management that she retired from, so she knows of what she speaks and is something of a community activist in this area, I would say. Green Sanctuary is affiliated with the Unitarian Universalist Fellowship.
Correct.
And I think has some interest in the area of waste and composting and things like that.
Absolutely.
So, yeah. So, Nancy, if you're out there, we have these guests here. If you've got a question that I don't put forward, we'd love to hear from you. And we'd also love to hear people's tips. I mean, if this is important for you and you've got some tips on how you manage not to end up throwing away food yourself, we'd love for you to give us a call. You can participate with us today on the show by calling 550-8433 in Anchorage or 1-888-353-5752. And we can also welcome your email at hometown@alaskapublic.org. And the show streams at for people who are outside of Anchorage at www.alaskapublic.org. So you can also listen to it on your computer. All right. Well, so let's get started. One of the things I wanted to do right away is to clear up my use of the word hunger and conflating it with the idea of food insecure. So I heard from a listener this morning who reacted to my radio promo and said that really 1 in 7 people in Alaska calling them hungry is really their food insecure. So I thought, well, this is great. We're going to talk about this with Carla for just a moment. So to share, you know, she's actually correct. I mean, food insecure, why don't you go ahead and tell us what it is, Carla?
Well, the pictures we have of hunger are often the kinds of things we see on TV, famines, or we know from history, the Irish potato famine, where many, many people died. Or even someone on a street corner with a sign. Most of the hunger, by far the most, is not visible. It's what we call food insecurity. It's people, families, seniors who have, and this is the definition of food insecurity, they lack reliable access to enough nutritious food. Mm-hmm. And so certainly some of those people are hungry. Those people who are food insecure are hungry, but they're hungry at times. Mm-hmm. They're not in danger of death because they never have food mm-hmm. available. We have a recent study of people using our network of 300 food pantries and other meal programs around the state. And what they tell us about themselves gives us a picture of people who every month struggle to have enough to buy groceries and pay the rent. Or they may be people who, whenever something happens that's unexpected, they need a car repair. Mm-hmm. Or they need to go to the doctor, then they're not able to have enough for groceries that last mm-hmm. week of the month before the paycheck comes.
So what? That's the one in seven.
That's the one in seven. Okay. And so when they don't have enough to put food on the table, or mom and dad are not eating so that the kids can have dinner, they're certainly hungry, mm-hmm. But not in the same way that, not in the same life-threatening way we think of when we see famine.
Right, right. So I thought it was worth the discussion because I didn't mean to mislead people and suggest that we're worse than the Irish famine or whatever. So I just wanted to thank Karen for sending that in, and I wanted to devote a little bit of time to just, you know, touch on that so people have the right information. So let's see. I think I'm going to start with you, Danny, because there is an initiative in the country to limit or cut back the amount of organic matter that ends up in landfills, something like by 50% by 2030. And I think it's a USDA, the Secretary of Agriculture is part of this. So do you want to mention that at all? I mean, it's a
sure.
fact. Why don't you just fill us in a little bit on it?
Yeah. Thanks a lot, Kathleen. Before I jump into that, I just wanted to follow up on this sort of definition discussion. With Carla about the word food security, because in Alaska we hear that a lot, and I travel a lot in rural areas in Alaska, and I hear a lot of people talking about food security. And I think there's a lot of different definitions, and it means something different to different people. And Carla gave a great definition of kind of what it means to the Food Bank of Alaska and how that community thinks about it. But you know, when I travel to rural areas, people talk about food security, and I think they're talking more about maybe more traditional uses of food and access to subsistence resources and how their lives are changing
in context,
whether it's climate change or just, you know, it might be the price of fuel that makes it more difficult to get on a snow machine and hunt or fish, and that they're feeling that food insecure from that perspective, that may be more of almost a cultural definition of food security. I also hear people talk about food security in terms of, well, how many days of food do we have on the shelves? Basically, they're saying, how well prepared are we for some disruption in our food supply? Are we prepared for the next emergency, earthquake?
Start pulling stuff back out of the landfill to eat it, right?
Right. How secure are we in case of emergency? So food security also has sort of emergency preparedness definition.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I think to me, it also makes us think about, well, what is our food system? Like, in a food system, the word food system means, like, what's the description of where we get our food from, who eats it? And then that does lead us to this question about food waste. How do we dispose of it? It's sort of this big circle of where does our food come from, how does it get consumed, and then what do we do with the waste? And in Alaska, if you think about our food system, you know, 95% of the food we eat is imported, is either flown up or barged up or trucked up here.
I think Carla said, when I was talking to her on the phone, that someone did, that our food comes up and often it's near the sell-by date when it gets here. So,
right.
Yeah, I mean, we mm-hmm. don't think about that, but our situation in Alaska is really unique mm-hmm. In that regard. There are some
right.
places...
I think about, like, solutions to all of those food security concerns, you know, it makes you kind of go back and say, well, what does our food system look like, and is it working for us? Does it provide healthy food for Alaskans? Does it, keep our cultures alive? Does it prepare us for the next emergency? Does it create economic opportunities? You know, Alaskans spend about $2 billion a year on food, and if 95% of that food is being shipped up, that means we are exporting $2 billion, food dollars, out of our community, out of our state, to somebody else in the lower 48. Could we be more food secure, or sort of more economically strong, if we were maybe producing more of our own food right here
yeah.
in Alaska?
Well, Danny, I'm gonna stop you there. I want to come back to this, but I want to get our other guests on the air too and let them sort of flow in. And I want to encourage you to jump in and continue conversing with us. I don't want you to sit quietly back there and not say another peep. So if the food system or sort of the 30,000-foot view is relevant, please just jump back in. But I want to sort of bring in our other guests a little bit. I guess I am thinking about the fact that even the food bank cannot use all the food that it gets, and sometimes it's out of date. And I know, Carla, you mentioned that you can even share this with farmers in the valley. Some of the out of date food even goes up to the farmers in the valley, but some of it does end up in the landfill. And Anchorage, I don't know if we have any data on how much does go into our landfill. And I'm looking at Mark, but he might not have that number. I didn't warn him that. But what I did learn by going to our solid waste site and reading about it is that we have a gas to energy project, which is a way of using some of this methane gas. So it doesn't really cut down on what's in our landfill, but you're using it.
Well, yes. If you look at it, Anchorage produces about 300,000 tons of trash a year that comes to the landfill. And out of that, probably over half of it is organic material of some sort. Food for one aspect of it is actually very beneficial to us at the landfill in our project, because it degrades very quickly and most of it's literally water. What we do with as the trash degrades, it produces methane gas, which we started about 2 years ago, a project that we sell the gas. We sell it to Doyon Utilities, and they produce about 7 megawatts of electricity. So, mm-hmm. So when you do send something to the landfill, it's you can rest assured that it's not just going away.
Yeah. You know, I saw some science papers that were a little over my head, but there was this idea that you need organic material in the landfill.
Yes,
to a certain
do.
Extent.
You do, just to promote, to get the degradation of everything else started,
yeah.
and to promote things, yes.
Right. So, but I gather we can deal with a lot less. I mean, we could still degrade with less going into our landfill?
Well, you know, there's always the push to reduce, reuse, and recycle before you actually deposit things in the landfill. But as I say, being the landfill operator and the gas plant operator, I'm always happy to take it from you.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So. Yeah.
Nationwide, EPA's got some statistics about that, about food is the largest component of municipal solid waste in all of our landfills across the country, and they also all landfills create methane, and I would say that a lot of them don't capture it and use it like we do here in Anchorage, so it generates methane, which is a greenhouse gas, which is 20 times more potent than carbon dioxide. So that generation of methane, can have a beneficial effect by creating some energy, but it can also, go to greenhouse gases.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And that's true. And I think if you look in the EPA stuff, there are actually probably, I think it's up to 600 different landfills around the country these days that are actually capturing their methane and using it. About 80% do what we do, which is you put it directly into generating systems and produce electricity, but there are a few others. But you're right, the degradation in the methane is a greenhouse gas. Most landfills, most larger landfills, are required by law to capture and destroy the methane portion, at least. And that's how we actually got into the business. We were required by law to
Oh, I did not know that.
Yes, we were required back in 2006 to start collecting and destroying it. And so all of a sudden, now we were collecting thousands of cubic feet of gas a minute and trying to figure out, well, what to do with it besides shoot it up a flare. Mm-hmm. And so we put out an RFP, and the project with Doyon Utilities came out as a real win-win situation for the municipality, for Doyon Utilities, and also for J-Bear. They get a very good return on their investment. They were the major investors in the project. But they get their electricity at a significantly reduced rate than what they were paying before. So,
mm-hmm. And you know, I can you help me figure out how much energy that is? Is it like thousands of light bulbs, or half a city, or half of the base?
In the summertime, we can actually produce enough electricity to power the entire Fort Richardson side of the base. In the wintertime, because of the additional lighting and heat and what have you, we produce about two-thirds of the electricity for the Fort Richardson side. And 7 megawatts is about the equivalent of 7,000 to 7,500 homes, the electricity that 7,000 to 7,500 homes uses every year. Mm-hmm. So,
it's better than just burning it up into the environment.
Didn't it result in the closure of Fort Richardson's power plant? So you actually reduced power generation?
No, the Fort Richardson power plant had been closed for quite a few years, but the idea of our project is that, much like food security, we're the energy security for Fort Richardson. Mm-hmm. Because as I say, we can produce enough electricity to power all of the vital systems on the base in the event of a major outage of all the other power around us, and being the fuel supply right next door to the base and right next door to the power plant, it really reduces the potential for a total loss of energy to the base.
Yeah. I think it was Kathy told me that you maybe did this similar work at Merrill Field or something like that.
Actually, that's where I got started in the landfill gas business.
New career.
Back when they were closing the landfill back in 1980, I started on it in 1985, and at that time my boss said, "Now there's a project you can retire on," and I hate to say that he might be right, but yeah. But at that time, the landfill gas to energy business was actually fairly young, and also there wasn't a lot of research, and there was actually a research paper out that was published that said that we in Alaska probably couldn't have landfill gas because our ground is so cold. So my first project was to debunk that paper. We really tried at one time to develop a gas energy project for Merrill Field, but because we were so there were so many unknowns to what we were doing at the time, it never quite worked out.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But it was the genesis of the idea. So
yes.
So well, listen. I thank you, and Mark. I'm glad to have you on, and glad because so many people I spoke with didn't know that we were doing that, and I think it makes people feel good that we're not wasting. If we're throwing it in there, we're at least getting some use out of it. But I do want to go to sort of the consumer level, because that's where the question sort of came from Nancy. She's like, what can I do? And I don't know if folks heard this part, but she had done some reading and she had heard of this plan, which is the top shelf in the fridge. And what it means is you go through your fridge and look for your aging vegetables or whatever is in there. And if it's getting kind of marginal, you put it on the top shelf and you eat it tomorrow. And I thought that was kind of practical. But with Kathy, when we were talking before the show, Kathy is with Green Sanctuary. And really had a whole career in waste management, but now with your church, you're pretty active in it. And we were talking about how a lot of these principles in the kitchen are really old and kind of fell away and are coming back. And we both commented on old cookbooks.
Yeah, they're kind of the literal real home economics.
Yeah.
And I have an old cookbook, a Betty Crocker cookbook from the 50s that talks about if you buy a chicken, use every single bit of it. And it tells you how to make chicken stock and chicken soup and what to do with the leftovers.
Mm-hmm.
And interestingly enough, I picked up a cookbook today in the Weight Watcher meeting room called I Love Leftovers, where it tells you how to make a meal and then four other things to do with what's left over from that meal. So it's true home economics. So even if you think, you know, for some reason I can't reduce how much I throw away, well, think how much you're spending in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
And Mark already mentioned the hierarchy: reduce, reuse, recycle. The first thing you do is reduce. You don't buy 24 apples if you can only eat 3 apples.
Mm-hmm.
Even though you can give the almost bad apples to the food bank, who then will feed them to the pigs in the valley, the point is, it's actually cheaper to buy the 3 apples at the grocery store than to buy the 12 or 24 apples at Costco if you're going to be throwing away half of what you bought.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Reduction is the first thing. Only buy what you know that you can eat in the time frame that that vegetable or fruit is good for.
Right. And so I do think these are old principles, but I guess we sort of need to be reminded, you know. And as I mentioned, we've got this link to the No Waste Kitchen Handbook, which is filled with these sorts of things, you know, and reducing, you know, don't go to the grocery store hungry. That's one of my big things. Or don't fantasize about what you're going to do with this food. I mean, one of the things is people are busy and they buy things, think they're going to cook a homemade meal, and then they never get to that homemade meal, and then that, you know. So you have to be realistic about your time. Those are some of the tips that I picked up. Carla shared a really great website with us, and it's on our alaskapublic.org. It's The Food Keeper. Let's talk a little bit about that.
It's the Food Marketing Institute, The Food Keeper, and it's what we use at Food Bank of Alaska when we evaluate whether or not food that's donated to us is still good for people to eat. And often food is still very good to eat for quite some time after its use-by date or best-by date. And this website allows consumers to look up the food you've got in your cupboard or in your refrigerator and check out if it's still probably good to eat. Mm-hmm. When members of the community think about whether or not to donate to Food Bank of Alaska, even if the expiration date is passed, let us decide. We would appreciate
that.
You donating it because we sort all the food that comes in.
You're mindful of those dates.
And our volunteers are looking at data like the Food Keeper to make decisions about if this food is still good.
Yeah.
And I'm glad you said that, because I had been told to never give expired food to the food bank. It sounds like that's not true.
That's not the case.
Great. Yeah. Thank you.
Yes. Let us decide. And you mentioned the pigs. You got a little ahead of us. We work with some farmers in the valley who raise pigs. And so when the food is no longer good to eat, or it comes to us past the date when it's good for human consumption, we do our best to minimize waste by donating that food out to pig farmers so it stays in the food system and does some good.
Right, right. That's good. I want to throw out our numbers one more time to folks. And if you have tips or if you have questions, we'd love to hear from you. In Anchorage, it's 550-8433 or 1-888-353-5752 statewide. Or give us an email at hometown@alaskapublic.org. Danny, I realize I never let you actually lay out the USDA initiative. We started talking about the big food system. Is there anything more to that is, you know, useful? Why did the administration jump on it? Obviously, we throw away too much, and that's why they're jumping on it. But
right, and I think that is kind of where it starts from. And the USDA has done some agricultural research, and some of the numbers that really are kind of floor you. Let me just give you some of that. So of all the food supply that we have in the United States, and we have a great food supply. You know, the United States produces, one of the most productive food supplies. But of our food supply, 31% of it goes to waste.
It's discouraging.
So that's 133 billion pounds of food that ends up mostly in municipal solid waste. So the secretary and the EPA administrator just recently joined to set a waste reduction goal. Earlier in 2013, we'd set up like a challenge, a food waste challenge, trying to engage schools and other private sectors and industry to join us in trying to help reduce food waste. And over 4,000 companies and other organizations have joined that challenge. But just now, last month in mid-September, announced this goal, calling for a 50%, as you said earlier, a 50% reduction by 2030. And I think that the goal is sort of part of one way, to measure how well we're doing, to set up, an additional challenge to meet that goal. I think it's part of other efforts that this administration has been doing, to reduce some climate change impacts and greenhouse gas pollution and some other things. So, just trying to tackle the food waste, I think, by setting a goal was, I think, just this most recent effort by the administration.
Yeah. Danny, the thing that got me when you were talking before was how expensive our food is up here. So we're throwing away very expensive food. Carla, you want to jump in?
Could I talk a little bit about how we work with the food industry?
Sure.
Food Bank of Alaska was founded back in 1979 by a number of people who were working with food programs around the community to get food to people in need. And they were looking, food banking was a new model at the time. They were looking for more efficient and more effective ways to eliminate the waste that occurred in the food industry when things came off the shelves, food came off the shelves that was still good to eat, and particularly when people were in need of food assistance. Mm-hmm. And so Food Bank of Alaska was the answer to that need. And what we do is, in a comprehensive way, work with the food industry. Our trucks go out daily and pick up from donors like Fred Meyer, mm-hmm. Safeway, Walmart, in the Anchorage and Mat-Su area, and then make that food available to our 120 partners who are feeding people in need in Anchorage and Mat-Su. Mm-hmm. And so our founder's first motto for Food Bank of Alaska was cash and save, cash, the C-A-C-H-E, cash,
yeah.
The Alaska cash, cash and save, don't waste food. Mm-hmm. So that was one of our main reasons for existence. And it's last year we collected 5.2 million pounds of food from the food industry that otherwise would have gone in the trash or mm-hmm. in the landfill. Mm-hmm. And so we very much appreciate those food industry donors. You, I believe, connected to the story that Ann Hillman did recently.
Right.
She talked with Stephen Longnecker, a manager at a Fred Meyer store, about how much Kroger had saved
yeah.
as a result yeah. of their donations to food banks where their stores are. So it's a very, very important program.
Yeah. Yeah.
And we're proud to do that and to get that food out as quickly as possible to people in need.
Yeah. Well, we're going to take a little break, but I just want to remind our audience who we're talking about wasting food and not wasting food and ways to do that, big ways to do that, individual ways to do that. And if you have ideas, we'd love to hear from you in the second half. You're listening to Danny Constantine with the USDA, Mark Madden with the Municipal Landfill, Carla Jutzi with Food Bank of Alaska, and Kathy Steen with Green Sanctuary. And I'm Kathleen McCoy, your host. You're listening to Hometown Alaska.
You're listening to Hometown Alaska from Alaska Public Media. The program repeats tonight at 8 p.m. on KSKA Anchorage and will not be taking phone calls. You can find Hometown Alaska on iTunes or listen at alaskapublic.org.
Welcome back to Hometown Alaska. I'm your host, Kathleen McCoy, and we are talking about food waste and what goes into the landfill. We talked this earlier half hour about what our landfill does, which was, I guess, 80% of the landfills in the U.S. do this, something like that.
Well, 80% of the larger landfills.
Basically capture the methane gas and turn it into energy to, you know, light buildings. And it's happening here on our own base. They're buying some pretty low-cost energy from the landfill. So.
Yeah, absolutely. It's kind of the last step of recycling is that we take the waste and actually make a valuable product out of it.
Yeah, so. Yeah. So that was Mark Madden. He's with the landfill. We have Carla Jutzi with Food Bank of Alaska, Kathy Steen with Green Sanctuary, and of course Danny's still on the line with us with the USDA up in Palmer. I wanted to, you know, in loyalty to Nancy who gave us the story, I wanted to throw in some more personal tips or consumer tips. And one thing that I'll start with Carla was the Food Keeper, and she has a few examples of the kind of thing that one of the books I read talked about how grandma didn't know when the yogurt was out of date because they didn't have dates on yogurt back when, you know, she knew how to tell whether it was good or bad. I also read that the dates are actually not regulated. You might assume that it's, I think I assumed, oh yes, someone's watching out for my health and they don't want me to eat this after a certain date. But it sounds like they're not regulated from what I've read and also maybe even set by the industry to make sure food keeps moving, you know. So it's really important to know about those dates. So I'm going to go to Carla. She has a few examples of things that might surprise you.
Well, I would refer you to others who are more expert on this for mm-hmm. what the various dates mean.
Yeah.
Some are used by, some are best by.
Yeah.
And best by often means it's at its best taste up to this date. But after that, it's still quite nutritious and healthy, but it's not doesn't meet the manufacturer's standard for perfection.
Mm-hmm.
But Food Keeper, for example, says that canned goods that are such as meat, poultry, carrots, corn, pasta, potatoes, are good for 2 to 5 years unopened in your pantry.
Past the date?
2 to 5 years altogether.
Altogether, okay.
You want to make sure, of course, that the can is not broken, not allowing air in. So as long as the can is good.
The seal, right.
The seal is good. Stored in your pantry, they're good for 2 to 5 years. Canned goods that are high in acids, such as tomatoes, sauerkraut, fruits, vinegar-based foods, mm-hmm. those are good for only about a year to 18 months. So you treat those a little bit differently.
Right. So that's I think that's very useful. The food keeper is going to be something I get more familiar with. That's the food in marketing industry has put it together. And there's an app. You can actually put it on your phone. And I don't know what, you know, you're going to find things that are up to date in the grocery store. So I don't know it's that helpful to have it on your phone. But go ahead, Kathy.
I was just thinking that's useful for home canners, too, because mm-hmm. we don't have dates written on our cans, but I can tell you, you know, how long the tomatoes have been there or how long the raspberry jam has been there. So that's mm-hmm. nice to know.
Yeah, yeah. So the food keeper, that's a link on our site. And I want to throw out our numbers, too, by the way. We're at 550-8433 in Anchorage, 1-888-353-5752. Or you can email us at hometown@alaskapublic.org. Kathy, in talking with you, I could tell that you're one of those people that has the kitchen managed well, because you made a reference to, you know, cooking and making extra, freezing some, eating another meal of this on Thursday, you know. Did that come from your mom? Did you just develop that? I mean, where did that come from? And what other things do you want to share with us that you do?
Well, I think it came from both my mom and my husband's mom, both of whom were Depression-era people. And leftovers was never a bad word in our house. And we've actually realized that cooking once and then having three meals out of it saves us a lot of time mm-hmm. and money. If you are buying a large amount of something and you want to use all of it before it goes bad, you may as well make a triple batch. So yeah. It's funny you remembered Thursdays because, yeah, Thursdays always left overnight at our house.
Oh, is it?
but, yeah. Yeah, we'll make basically three times what we need and separated into three portions, one for now, one for later this week, and one that we freeze. And that's actually one of the things, it's freeze it immediately. Don't decide a week later that you want to freeze it, because then it's that close, much closer to being moldy.
Oh, you know? Okay. I hadn't thought about it, because I tend to think, oh, I haven't gotten to that. I better throw it in the freezer when it's been sitting there for 2 or 3 days. That's not the way to go. I'm going to welcome someone on the show. Shelley from Homer, welcome to Hometown Alaska.
I just wanted to say thanks to Danny Constantine for coming up with the funding for these high tunnels in Homer and Kodiak. We got over 300 high tunnels.
Wow.
And it's a huge difference in our food security. And to go from that to basically talking about the nutritional value of leafy greens, you know, you pay top dollar for organic leafy greens in the grocery store, but really the nutritional value is shot after about 3 days. So we never see imported foods like that that are at peak nutritional value.
As if you pulled that carrot from your garden tonight. Yeah, right.
Yeah, pull it from your garden tonight. And then that's the next thing, backyard gardens.
Uh-huh.
I mean, it's something that people just aren't thinking about, you know, in Alaska as much as they could be, especially in urban environments. But
right.
You know, it costs 69 cents for a bag of seed, and you can get with your neighbors and buy a whole bunch of them, and you can plant tons of food.
Yeah.
I had kids over at the barn the other day moving the freezer, and they looked inside the freezer, and they said, we had no idea you could freeze stuff like this. I mean, it's full of fish, but it also had all the boat food from out in Chignik. It had, you know, the cheese and everything else, and we'll use all that this winter.
Uh-huh, yeah.
So it's teaching kids how to eat, how to grow food, and how to put food away. You know, you say there's no dates on jars. Well, all my cans have 2015 on them, and they pretty much, you know, get all used up.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. By the way, in case people don't know what those high tunnels are, those are like those they give you a warmer environment for your vegetables, and they're simple to snap together. I in case people don't know what they are, Shelley, just give us a quick definition.
Well, the Department of Agriculture, I think it was part of Michelle Obama's initiative to end childhood obesity, but also to provide food security. They did a pilot program to see, you know, and I think it was in 30-tier states. Danny probably knows better than I do, but put these high tunnels out there, and you paid about half, and USDA paid half. And, I mean, it's just been an absolutely amazing program, and I think now it's really, you know, stock and trade for USDA.
Yeah. So if someone hears this and they want to find out more, how do they find out more? I mean, you guys were in on it, but is it still available? What's going on? And maybe Danny has to jump in.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Danny.
So this is a program of one of the USDA agencies called the Natural Resource Conservation Service, or NRCS. So, you know, I think that's where you would want to Google High Tunnel and USDA NRCS. And they're right here in this office in Palmer. They have offices, but they also have offices in Homer and Fairbanks and all across the state. So I would just either go to the website or go to a local USDA office and find out more about these high tunnels. They're also called season extenders, and that's the other thing they do, and they're really good for northern climates like Alaska, because you can start planting your leafy greens and other vegetables earlier in the season, you know, in March or April, you've already got some things growing, and then later in the season, like now, September, October, you can kind of protect some from early frosts, and you can keep growing. So it extends our growing season.
Again,
it's basically a passive greenhouse. It's just a big plastic covers that just, as Kathleen said, just warms up the air, warms up the soil, extends the season, and also allows us to just produce more, grow more in that warmer environment, that things just grow better and grow faster.
And as Shelley said, I mean, if you pull it out of the ground tonight, it's going to be more nutritious. It's going to have more of that value still in it. That's just one of the hazards of living in Alaska. So much comes from so far away and spends time in storage before it gets here and things like that. So, Shelley, thank you so much. I want Kathy to jump in here. She was signaling me while you were talking. Is it about the high tunnels?
It is. Shelley, I just wanted to say hi. And Danny, also thank you. We got two of the high tunnels a couple of years ago. Where we found the information was on the EQIP website, EQUIP.
Okay.
So when I Google that, it takes you to the High Tunnel program.
Okay. Well, thank you, everybody, for that. That was I sort of had heard about them, but I didn't really realize there was a movement, you know, and that there's even discounts maybe to getting them.
Well, you sign up to get one, and they tell you how many what they're going to pay per square foot. So you can buy whatever you want, but you only get paid a certain amount. And that's why Shelley said she got paid about half. And you are offering for 3 years to give data to the USDA. So every year we had to do temperature readings, we had to do soil nutrients, and Danny's folks there in Palmer give you all your nutrient data. To me, we were getting the deal. They were paying us to do it, but we were getting the good deal because their soil nutrient people were helping us out. They had us test our compost to see if it was doing what we needed it to do. It was a very useful program. We learned a lot from it.
That's great.
And we have two high tunnels.
That's great. I want to welcome Susan from Palmer. You're on Hometown Alaska. Hi, Susan.
Hi. I really appreciated your program. There's a lot of very interesting subjects that have been covered. I just wanted to give my view on an earlier comment that was made. The lady was speaking, and she gave a term. I don't quite remember it. Would you refresh me? She was speaking about people who are hungry, but they're not starving. There was a term that was...
Food insecure? Given. Is that what you're thinking, Susan? Food insecure?
Yeah, food insecure. I get I'm used to different terms, and I always take interest, I guess, in how we use our English. Words, I guess, fascinate me. I'd like to share with you a term that the government classifies me under that causes me to cringe and laugh at the same time.
Hello? I think we've lost her signal. Or if she comes back, we'll welcome Susan back. But I do not hear her. So, okay.
Kathleen, you know, one area I wanted to just touch on a little bit that USDA is really interested in is reducing food waste in schools. And there's all kinds of kind of new things that sort of strategies for smarter lunchrooms that USDA has been working on too. You know, extending the lunch period for a little bit longer, allowing kids to eat their food late. sort of save it and eat it later in the day, set up a table where kids can place things that they're not going to eat, letting a little bit more sort of self-serve so kids don't take too much and then throw it away, more encouraging more composting for schools and school gardens. Mm-hmm. So schools is a huge area where there is a lot of waste, and I think there's a lot of area for improving and reducing food waste in schools.
That's good. I hadn't thought about that. That's good. You know, I did try to get some grocery folks on here in the middle of the day. They just cannot get away. But I did want to thank Stephen at Fred Meyer. Mm-hmm. He actually introduced me via email to Cora over at Nusagaya, and we were trying to work with Cora to see if she could come on, and she couldn't get away. But she did say that they could use even more pickup. I mean, they acknowledge a great relationship with the food bank and really appreciate that. But she said, sometimes it'll happen on the weekend where we've got fresh stuff and we don't have any room to store it in, and there really isn't pickup. And I thought it was worth throwing that out there, not to say that, the food bank has to figure out how to pick up everything on Saturday and Sunday too, but there may be someone out there with an idea of how that might help. But they were very appreciative and a little frustrated that sometimes they still have stuff they can't move off to you. Yeah.
One of our programs that we really appreciate, and it keeps growing, is the Mobile Food Pantry. Anchorage East Rotary Club helped us get that started about 9 years ago. And we take food out to 9 different locations in Anchorage at various times during the week. And it's a way we get highly perishable food out the door just as fast as we can.
Mm-hmm.
And we take it into neighborhoods. People appreciate that it's close to their home, so transportation is less of an issue. And it carries produce, dairy, bread, that sort of highly perishable donated food.
Right. Well, that's great. So, let's see, I'm trying to think of, we have 15 minutes. We still have time to really cover some areas. And what haven't, I know we talked a little bit about some composting. We talked about lasagna composting because, again, it's like, as Danny has said, it's more than just your trash can. It's really planning. It's, growing more yourself and then using it. So I kind of wanted to get Kathy talking just a tiny bit about composting, because right now is the time of year when you might be setting some of that up, right?
Well, it's when you would probably be setting up what we call lasagna beds. And there's a little question usually about what that means. It's not a bed that grows lasagna. It's rather basically a horizontal compost pile. And you would put in a layer of your food scraps and a layer of dry leaves and a layer of nutrient, like maybe fishbone meal, all the different layers that you would normally put into a compost pile. Oh, a nice layer of manure to heat everything up. So you do it in the fall, and in the spring, what you started with, maybe an 18-inch to 2-foot stack of leaves and straw and manure and everything else, is now about a nice 6-inch bed ready to plant your vegetables in.
Right. And people aren't really thinking about it. They think about it in April, and they're like, I want green.
And then you wish you'd done it.
And you wish you'd done it. So it's good to know that now's a good time. And I didn't know it would be that effective. Or maybe my compost is not that effective.
Well,
but
the first year I did it, and it was with Green Sanctuary. We have a master gardener there who taught us how to do it. It was myself and some of the youngsters. And we actually did it in April. You build the whole pile, but then you have to put soil on it, which kind of doesn't defeat the purpose, but you didn't want to add that. So that you can plant the plants. But by the end of the season, by the fall, it was a nice low bed with rich black soil in it. And we planted peas in it, and they did quite well. One of the things I think Carla had mentioned, or maybe you had mentioned, getting kids to eat right. The interesting thing that summer is every Sunday, our RE director, our religious education director, would leave snacks for the kids to eat. And by the third Sunday that we actually started harvesting, the kids would say, I don't want a granola bar. I want to go get a carrot or some lettuce. I want to get something I grew. And so to watch these kids go from vegophobes to someone who wanted to eat what they had grown that was a huge
triumph. That's great. I want to touch on, we got a couple of emails, and so I'd just like to share their thoughts. One listener is talking about in large cities where residents don't have a lot of food storage, she's noticed that grocery stores will sell a single stick of butter or they'll sell a single egg. And she's just throwing this out there that she would really like to see that sort of thing happening in Anchorage. And she understands that the price per unit is going to be higher, but she sort of said, throw that out to your panel and see what they have to say. I'm getting some shaking heads, yes. Any comments on that, Kathy?
That's that perfect waste reduction. You only buy what you need. You buy what you're going to use before it goes bad. When I was selling food at farmers markets a couple years ago because my high tunnel did so well, people would ask me, for example, for a sprig of dill. And you think about what you buy in the grocery store. You buy this huge package of dill. You use one sprig. The rest goes bad because you only had one recipe. So it was fun to sell people a sprig of dill, knowing that's exactly what they want.
That, yeah, they're only buying what they need. I think about that. I think about the herbs I buy. I buy fresh herbs and use them in the recipe, and then they get stuck down there. And then months later, I find them. And I was thinking, well, maybe I could freeze these. You know, what can I do?
Oh, you can freeze them.
Yeah.
People will take herbs, chop them up, put them in your ice cube tray with water, freeze them. Now you have an ice cube full of that herb. Mm-hmm. So when you say, want to throw it into chicken soup, you just throw the whole ice cube in,
mm-hmm.
and you've got the thyme or the oregano or the mm-hmm. whatever it was.
Yeah,
you can also dry them. Again, mm-hmm. you've got to do it immediately when you
when they're at their peak.
Exactly. And yeah. for that, what I do is I tie them together, I hang them upside down, and place a paper bag around them so that they don't get dusty.
Mm-hmm.
And I put them in a cool, or not cool, but a dark place. It can
mm-hmm.
be warm.
Mm-hmm.
And you just open it up a couple weeks later, and usually it's nice and dry and just crunchy. And so we grow a lot of our own herbs, and we do that when we have some from the store that we're not going to use. Something like chives or leeks, you can chop up and just freeze as they are.
Mm-hmm.
And then you can just take them out, grab them, throw mm-hmm. them in your dish how you want to.
I got very good at freezing my raspberries on a flat tray. Freeze them up nice and hard and then bag them up and then they're
yeah.
great.
Then they're nice and loose.
So yes.
They're not all stuck in one big lump.
It's not some big chunk that you have to break up. Carla, go ahead.
The whole idea of choice is important too, as Danny was mentioning with school lunch programs. We try to implement that with our food pantry partners who receive government food, and some of the government food that we ship out to various locations, there's not much choice. There's kidney beans, and there's this, and there's that.
Mm-hmm.
And so what we encourage, and ConocoPhillips helps us with a grant for this purpose, we encourage that they come up with ways that they can give people choice, even if it's limited choice. So,
mm-hmm.
for example, if I know my family is not going to eat the kidney beans, I can put the kidney beans on a share table and pick up something that someone else has left behind
on the share
that
table.
My family will
mm-hmm.
eat and enjoy.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's very important
that's
as well.
Good.
Plus, it respects people's dignity.
Right.
It says we understand that people who are in need of food have preferences just like
everybody
people
else
who
right.
are shopping at the grocery store
right,
for food.
Right.
So.
I'm going to pull in another one of our emails here. This is a question. What happens to food that is left over from banquets and other catered events at municipal facilities here in Anchorage? Does anybody have any insight on that?
I know when I got married, we had Mayflower Catering, and after the reception, we had some food left, and my bridesmaid said, I'm going to pack this up and take it to the food bank. And Mayflower Catering looked at her and said, well, that's what we were going to do.
Yeah.
So I don't know if all caterers do that.
Well, Food Bank of Alaska cannot accept food that's open and has been used. Our food, the food we are able to distribute, has to be sealed, and so that it can verify the safety. Some of our partners in Anchorage and the Valley who have meal programs do accept that kind of food. So I would suggest you contact Beans Cafe, Downtown Soup Kitchen, and others that are preparing meals for people.
And
yeah, see if they can take that.
Yeah,
I said food bank, and it was Beans Cafe. They were going to take
that
it too.
That's correct.
Thanks. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. We did have another email from a listener who really, Danny touched on it. She's talking about the amount of waste there are in schools. And she works locally and sees unopened milk cartons thrown away and things like that. And I think we really did touch on that. Danny talked about some new initiatives that the USDA is really interested in. Here's one. We were asking for people's tips, and this woman says, I live in Anchorage and I have backyard chickens. I had a whole show on backyard chickens once. It was really fun. I supplement their feed with my garden scraps, kitchen scraps, and extra food. In return, I get wonderful eggs. As I generally eat organic and locally produced food, my eggs are mostly organic as well. Giving them my scraps cuts down on the expense for their feed, so it's a win-win for her. So those are great suggestions. I appreciate that. Let me see. Is this one more that we? No, we covered that one. So let's see. We did the composting. Go ahead, Carla.
A very small thing I do is make my own vegetable broth, which I prefer to the vegetable broth I'd buy at the store. So when I cut the end off a carrot or the center out of a bell pepper or whatever it is, when I'm preparing food, I throw it in a freezer bag in the freezer, and then on a Saturday afternoon when I'm at home, throw it in a pot with a couple of bay leaves and let it simmer for 2 hours, and I have broth.
Do you strain it at
yes.
the end? So then it's good. And then how long can that, do you use it right away or can you keep it for a while? Don't know.
I keep it for a little while.
Not
it
too
tells
long.
Me when it's done.
Oh, okay. Okay.
But you can freeze that too.
Yeah.
We freeze our chicken broth and veggie broth and just pull it out when we need it instead of buying it in the store.
Yeah. Yeah. It's amazing. Yes. Hi, Danny. You're still with us.
Just wanted to jump in. And I think all these suggestions for what you can do in your own home are really great, whether it's feeding them to your chickens or, you know, reducing the source and just, you know, reducing and reusing before you try to, you know, try to put it into our landfill system. But I also think that there's kind of larger policy, there's potential for Alaska to move in a direction where we're more secure and maybe reduce our waste more and deal with sort of larger institutions. And I just wanted to mention a group that I'm involved with called the Alaska Food Policy Council, and they're more involved in sort of looking at what kind of policies should change. How can we deal with food waste, or how can we deal with being better prepared for emergencies, or how can we deal with producing more food, whether it's with high tunnels or with larger farms in Alaska? And I would just encourage people to kind of check out the Alaska Food Policy Council website and get involved. If you want to join with this kind of a coalition of farmers and fishermen and businessmen and universities and state agencies and federal agencies are all kind of working together. And the food bank is part of the Food Policy Council. All kind of working together to look at our larger food system and recommend some policies to our policymakers, to our governor, to our legislators, on some ideas, whether it's to increase composting or increase access to healthy food for all Alaskans, but kind of look at how our policymakers can get involved as well.
Right. You and I were talking. I can remember when Anchorage did have a community composting area out by the airport, and I don't know whether it was the city's or it was a private enterprise. I don't remember. But you could go out there, and I used to love to go out there and see these big piles of compost that they had. I mean, they just were beautiful. And, you know, for whatever reason, we don't have that anymore. But I think, you know, consumers letting people know what they're interested in is a really, really important part of the solution. So I guess it's time to go, guys. We have to say thank you. I want to say thank you to Danny. Thanks for sitting with us this whole hour from Palmer, Danny. I really appreciate it with the USDA.
I really enjoyed it.
Yes, thanks, Danny. And Mark Madden was here from the Municipal Landfill. Thank you, Mark. We never got to ask you your kitchen tips, but we'll come back to that.
My favorite is the vacuum packer.
Okay. We didn't talk about that. And Carla Jetsy was here from the Food Bank of Alaska, and Kathy Steen was with us from Green Sanctuary. And thank you all, and thank you to our listeners and folks who sent emails. Next week on Hometown Alaska, Charles Wolforth will be back as your host, and his topic is climate change in Cook Inlet. Hometown Alaska is on the web at alaskapublic.org. Pat Yad is the Chief Content Officer for Alaska Public Media. Dave Waldron was our audio engineer today. Thanks for joining us on Hometown Alaska. I'm Kathleen McCoy.
Hometown Alaska is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and do not reflect the underwriters or KSKA. Hometown Alaska's theme song, Lead Dog, is by Kevin Barnett from Eagle River. Learn more about Hometown Alaska and listen online at alaskapublic.org. Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.